I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. It's Here and Now. Oil hit a new record today, going above $127 a barrel for the first time, putting upward pressure on prices for diesel, gasoline, and jet fuel ahead of the summer traveling season. And the White House announced this morning that the government of Saudi Arabia will not raise production of oil, as the White House had hoped. The Saudi stance is an apparent rebuff to President George Bush, who's in Saudi Arabia today in part to get the nation to increase production. To help us understand what's behind this price rise and the Saudi stance, we're joined by Tom Closa, Chief Oil Analyst for Oil Price Information Service, an independent market information company. And Tom, first, oil hit a new high today. Does that automatically mean a price increase at the gas station?
It does in this case. I mean, what you see at the gas pump really represents tape delay of what happens in the live format a few days beforehand. And we're almost certainly looking at prices that are going to be in the 380s nationally. And we've got a few states and certainly some major metro areas above $4 a gallon. So the short-term answer is more pain at the pump and much more so on diesel fuel than gasoline. That's going to move above $4.50 a gallon in the next week.
$4.50 a gallon. I thought it was only going to reach $4 this summer. But you write in your blog that the U.S. drivers are about to cross this threshold, spending more than $1.5 billion a day in gasoline. That's collectively, although it may feel that way at the pump sometimes.
Yeah, we're going to be spending about $1.5 billion, and that's about three times what we spent in 2002, and a quarter of $1 billion per day more than what we've spent on Memorial Day weekend in the last couple of years. So it's substantial. The problem is that some of the greater cost increases are seen where it doesn't have quite the resonance with the public, and the price of jet fuel and the price of diesel. That's what keeps our economy moving, and that's probably where we're in much more severe trouble than on the gasoline front.
Well, what is behind the rise in prices? The Saudis, in turning down President Bush's request, say they don't see the demand as being that high. But aren't we told that it's increasing demand from growing economies like India and China that are driving up the price?
Well, you know, there's a real debate going on about that right now. I mean, you could make the case that there really is no particular tightness or shortage, certainly, of oil supplies internationally. But the investment banks, the investment speculators really do believe that oil and assets that represent, or financial instruments that represent oil assets, are a very, very safe haven to be invested in for the next few years. Commodities in general, and oil very specifically, are becoming a home for billions and billions of dollars flowing into them. And I think some of us are hopeful that this really does represent irrational exuberance and money chasing money. I think that's the Saudi position, that it's not about actual supply and demand anymore. It's about the value of oil as a perceived asset to hold when equities, bonds, and real estate aren't really looking so wonderful.
Well, what about the Saudis? What is really behind their refusal to open their taps more? Are they at capacity?
No, they've got some extra capacity, and they've got some huge fields coming on at the end of this year, early next year. But I think that they probably would blame this on the financial markets. And, you know, it is one of their natural resources, and they don't want to deplete it or pump more, only to sort of pump money into the coffers of investors and speculators, as opposed to really create a market balance. Right now, the sentiment is very similar to the sentiment we saw at the housing top. Over 90% of all the money managers think oil prices are going up. And usually when you have that much of an imbalance, you better be careful because it might move the other way. We may say a couple of years from now, remember when we thought oil would be $150 to $200 a barrel, and maybe we'll be only $70 to $100 a barrel then. Let's hope so.
And meanwhile, Saudi Arabia says we're not going to produce any more right now. And really, America may be at a low in terms of influence over in Saudi Arabia. Security analyst Anthony Kordesman says it's not clear what incentive they'd have to do anything for us because he says we haven't delivered on Mideast peace. We can't deliver on the Iraq the Saudis want, and we're raising problems in terms of Iran. We're not in a great position on this, are we?
No, we don't seem to have too much leverage. And I think around the world there's also a sense that the United States leaders, and this is in both parties, tend to mislead the public, that we can drill our way out of this, we can use the bully pulpit to get a little bit of extra production, and we talk about energy independence. We're not going to have energy independence, particularly on the oil side, until it's preceded by some energy or some oil discipline. And we really still are quite undisciplined in the way we use fuel.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Okay. Thanks, Monica.
Tom Kloza, Chief Oil Analyst for Oil Price Information Service, an independent market information company. As we said, President Bush is in Saudi Arabia today, pushing that country to increase its oil production. Officials there said, no, thank you. The president arrived in Saudi Arabia from Jerusalem, where he helped celebrate Israel's 60th anniversary. Before there was an Israel, a rusty old American ferry boat carrying 4,500 Jewish refugees tried to run the blockade of then-British-controlled Palestine. It was 1947, and hundreds of thousands of Holocaust survivors were in displaced persons camps in Europe, with no homes to return to. And the British, fearful of escalating conflict between Jews and Arabs, would allow no more than 1,500 Jews a month into Palestine. But blockade runs were legend, and none more dramatic than the story of the Exodus 1947, a refugee ship that helped change the political landscape of the Middle East. Producer Sean Cole talked with three crew members from the ship, and together they tell the story.
You might have read the book Exodus, which is based on this story, or seen the Paul Newman movie, but you can forget them, because they're so heavily fictionalized they hardly resemble the real story, which is even more dramatic. But what's amazing about the journey of the Exodus is the number of ironies it involves. It's a war story that didn't happen during a war. One of the warring factions had just helped save the other from total extermination, and the ultimate victors weren't Paul Newman types.
My name is Nathan Nadler. I was an electrician on the Exodus.
My name is Frank Levine. I was an able-bodied seaman on the ship.
I was drafted into the U.S. Army at the very tail end of World War II. I didn't know anything about ships. I was in the infantry.
I learned to sail on the Charles River, and sympathetic Jewish sailors were very difficult to come by. There were guys with much more experience than I had.
They called me Big Bill, because I was the tallest guy on the boat, and I wouldn't take any crap from anybody.
Bill Millman. He is a fighter.
Before the Exodus? Well, I was 16 when I was in the Navy. I was 19 when I got on board the Exodus. But it wasn't called the Exodus when I first went aboard. It was the President Warfield, a dilapidated piece of junk that was drowning in the ocean.
The President Warfield was as unfit to take on the British military as the men who sailed her. She began life as an opulent pleasure steamer, entertaining her guests with dancing and fine food as she ferried them up and down the Chesapeake Bay.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast.
Then came World War II, and the Warfield was commissioned by the U.S. Navy, and they took it across the Atlantic.
It had acted as a headquarters vessel for the invasion of Normandy.
It was under attack from the Luftwaffe many, many times. The war was over. The Navy had no use for the Warfield, and so they sent it back across the Atlantic to Baltimore,
where it was sold to a secret Jewish military organization called the Haganah. This is around 1946. Jews all over Europe were stuck in what were called displaced person camps, or DP camps, trying to come to terms with the horrors they'd just endured.
I had experienced the concentration camp survivors in Munich for a year, and they told me stories of what they did to our people. It's 55 years later, and I still can't take it. I get very emotional about it. And, well, anyway, I came home, and I want to get back to Germany and continue helping the Jewish survivors.
About six, 8 months after the war was over, I got a phone call at home. The voice at the other end said, "I know you know how to sail, and would you like to help the Jews?"
Helping the Jews was what most of the crew had in mind when they climbed aboard the Warfield. The thing was, they didn't really know what that entailed. In fact, to hear Bill tell it, they thought they were going to Palestine to help the Jews who were already there.
Most of the crew that came aboard had no idea of what the purpose of the Warfield was going to be. We didn't know we were going to pick up Jews anyplace. And if the guys told you they knew, they're full of baloney.
The Warfield set out on its mission in March of 47. After stopping in the Azores and stealing fuel, the British had pressured the Portuguese not to sell them any, the crew found their way to the port of Marseille in the south of France.
And in Marseille, we were on one side of the pier, and on the other side of the pier were two British destroyers watching us intently to see what we were going to do.
So we got out. We ended up in a place called Porto Venere in Italy. This is where we tore out the interior of the ship.
In other words, we took out all the beds, the mirrors, the washstands, the dining room, the dance hall. We took out everything, and we had an empty shell. And we started to build the bunks.
You've seen pictures of the Jews in concentration camps where they slept on racks. We made racks for the Jews to sleep on. And there were about five deep. We were there for about 4 months, converting the ship that normally carried 350 people to carry 5,000 people.
And that's when we found out that we were going to run the British blockade. Up until that time, we didn't know.
We were supposed to pick up the people in different ports, but each one of them fell through. Disappointment. Terrible disappointment. We were all depressed. We said, we'll never pick up the people. It'll never happen.
And we head to the port of Sète in France.
We tied up. It was dusk. Well, let's see what's going to happen. We all thought nothing would happen. But at dawn, what a moving sight that was.
When we get up and looked up on the causeway, there are over 500 trucks and thousands of people walking around. Those are the passengers. Those are the people, the displaced persons.
All these trucks had rendezvoused from all the displaced person camps in Europe, from Czechoslovakia, Poland, Germany, all at the same July 47.
The crew loaded 4,554 refugees onto the ship. Everything seemed to be going according to plan until midnight, when the tugboat they'd paid to guide the ship out of port didn't show. So the crew had to make its way out to the Mediterranean on its own.
And there, waiting to greet us, are the two British destroyers that were in Marseille across from us in the pier. They watched the entire loading of the people on board the Warfield. They watched the entire loading.
And we started steaming towards Palestine.
It took the Warfield 7 days to reach its destination. By the time she got there, one crew member was dead at the hands of the British, and the ship would bear the name by which it later became famous. You'll hear how all that happened when our story continues after a short break, here and now. We continue now with the story of the Exodus 1947, the refugee ship carrying Jews from Europe that tried to run the British blockade of Palestine and ended up helping change the map of the Middle East. Producer Sean Cole picks up the story as the ship leaves the port of Sète in southern France, bound for Palestine.
Two British destroyers watched as more than 4,500 Jews from displaced persons camps all over Europe were loaded aboard the Warfield in the French port of Sète. And when the Warfield finally got underway, the same two British destroyers were lying in wait. Bill Millman, also known as Big Bill, was at the wheel of the Warfield.
On the first day out, we got one destroyer. Second day out, we got another destroyer. We now have four destroyers circling us. On the fourth day out, we get a minesweeper and cruiser Ajax.
My God, you see this gigantic warship shadowing you.
Frank Levine was an able-bodied seaman on the boat.
All right, fine. You're in international waters, but still it makes an impression.
They would turn their loudspeakers to us, and they would say, give up. You don't stand a chance.
Nat Nadler was a ship electrician.
We'd turn our loudspeakers to them and play Sir Edward Elgar's March, Pomp and Circumstance, if you're familiar with it.
On the fifth day, we changed the name of the warfield to the Exodus.
Gingy, the radio operator, got it from the Haganah in Palestine, and we painted on port and starboard. I got pictures of that. Exodus 1947. We were about 2 or 3 days off the coast of Palestine. When we got within 25 miles off the coast of Jaffa, the British attacked.
Wham! Two destroyers, one on either side, hit us. Wacko. Trying to get us to stop.
The first attack included searchlights, firecrackers, high-pressure water hoses, drawbridge, and the boarding party comes aboard.
That was crazy. There were two British sailors, armed, clubs, in one of the cabins. And I started schlepping one of these guys out by the arm. And he said to his mate, "Kill him, Harry, kill him." That was me. I was going to get killed, and they started clubbing me. I had blood all. Christ, I couldn't see. Yeah, I get out of there fast. I wanted to live to tell the story.
I was totally insane. And I picked up one of the Marines, and I was all set to throw him overboard when I got shot point blank on the left side of my jaw. And I almost went into the Mediterranean, except I hit the life rail, and I fell down, and they took me to the sick bay.
Before the battle was over, some 30 refugees were seriously wounded by the British. Two of them were shot and killed, including a 15-year-old boy. Nat Nadler still has a scar on his face where a British Marine landed his club.
And Bill and I are both in this hospital aid station.
Yeah, we end up in the same room in sick bay.
I'm on the lower bunk, and he's on the upper bunk. Both our heads were bandaged, and he could hardly talk. And I remember these words. He said, "Hey, Nadler, we really showed him, didn't we?" And I said, "Yeah, take a look at yourself, you big schmuck."
We fought and held off the British for 4 hours, from 2 to 6 in the morning. We had women and children aboard, and the side of the ship had been torn off. We surrendered.
As Haifa was still the closest port, the British brought the warfield to the shores of Palestine. Normally, refugees who tried to run the British blockade were taken to displaced person camps in Cyprus, but the British decided to make an example of the exodus. They sent the refugees back to France, but once there, the Jews refused to disembark.
And the British said to us, "If you're not off these ships within 24 hours, we're going to send you to Germany." Okay? Couldn't believe that the British would do this.
When the prison ships got to Hamburg, many of the refugees once again refused to disembark. This time, the British forced them out of the holds with tear gas and clubs and shipped them back to the kinds of camps they'd escaped just a month before. The Jews appeared to have lost. But in the wake of the Exodus affair, world opinion sided with the refugees, and the British were painted as brutish enforcers.
"We will proceed the whole call."
Now, the biggest, most important thing is the United Nations Sandstrom Commission investigating the Palestine problem was in Haifa.
They were pretty shaken up. They didn't expect to see what they had seen.
They came back to the General Assembly in New York, and they recommended that Palestine be partitioned and Israel was born.
"The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions."
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Partition passed, 33 to 13. And is this crowd excited? They're starting their horror dances now, all over the square, little circles of four.
I raised two sons, and I helped give birth to the State of Israel. How many people can say that? When I die, I have it already laid out on my tombstone. was a crew member of the Haganah ship Exodus 1947.
I did a job, okay? I did a job. I'm happy with the job I did. And when I go there, I see the results of what I did.
I got a line for you. How many times in one man's lifetime can you help create a country? And if you want to go back to Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all those gangsters who wanted to form a new country, I put myself in that category.
Bosun's mate, Bill Millman, from the public radio documentary Exodus 47, Inside Out. Both Big Bill Millman and his crewmate, Seaman Frank Levine, died in December of 2007. The ship's electrician, Nat Nadler, lives in New Jersey, where he has a second career as a psychoanalyst. Our story on the Exodus 1947 was produced by Sean Cole. For more, including pictures of the ship and its crew, go to our website, here-now.org.
He was an American. Now he is dead.
This dramatic 1968 CBS documentary on hunger in America, narrated by Charles Kuralt, shocked Americans. It spurred Congress to create the modern food stamp program. 40 years later, demand for food stamps is back at levels not seen since the 1960s and 70s. Food stamps and other nutrition programs now account for two-thirds of the nearly $300 billion farm bill passed by Congress this week, even though most of the debate centered on crop subsidies for farmers. The president has threatened to veto the bill, but Congress passed it by veto-proof margins. New York Times reporter Eric Eckholm joins us now. And Eric, you wrote about the recent spike in demand for food stamps. How many Americans need food stamps right now?
Well, close to 1 in 10 Americans are receiving food stamps or will be by the end of the year, according to federal projections. There's been a big rise in the last couple of years because so many basic costs of living have risen so fast. Gasoline, heating costs, food costs, and also wages have been stagnant for the bottom portion of the population.
So as you say, we're all facing higher food prices, higher fuel prices. But when it comes to food stamps, we're not necessarily talking about people who don't have jobs. I know it's complicated, but how do you qualify for food stamps?
Well, many people are working, but recipients tend to be very needy, and the income levels for eligibility are pretty low. It's 130% of the federal poverty rate, which means for a family of four, something like $25,000 a year. And you also can't have many assets if you have more than $2,000 or $3,000 in the bank or in holdings of some kind. Apart from your house and car, you're not eligible.
Well, as you said, many states are seeing an increase in demand for food stamps. You estimate about 1 in 10 Americans. Give us some specific examples of states and what they've seen in demand.
Well, one of the most dramatic examples is Michigan, where now 1 in 8 people receive food stamps. And officials say that their caseload has doubled over the last 8 years, and it's at an all-time record level. There are quite a number of states that are at a record level now, and nearly all the states have seen increases over the last 2 or 3 years. I just saw a news item yesterday from Florida that over the last year there, the number of recipients went up by 20%. In New York, 1 in 10 receives food stamps, and there was a rise over the last year of 6,000 to 7,000 people to about 1.9 million New Yorkers.
And Rhode Island is approaching 10% of the population on food stamps, I understand.
Yes, they had a rise of 18% over the last 2 years. And in all of these states, it's been a combination of the economic slowdown, rising unemployment, stagnant wages, and the efforts of the states to reach more of those people with information and get them to sign up. Another thing that has encouraged more people to sign up is that it used to be quite embarrassing. You'd walk in a store with a big wad of coupons, and at the cash register, everybody would see that you're fumbling through them, and the stores didn't like to deal with them. But nowadays, people get electronic debit cards, so it just looks like you're using a credit card to pay.
So it's a much easier way to do it, and it's less obvious. So that might explain why more people want to use it?
That helps explain. I mean, that's one of the reasons, but I think the underlying factor has to be economic need. You know, I've met poor families in the South with four or five children who are getting as much as, you know, $500, even $600 worth of food stamps every month. And this is a really vital survival thing for them. That's probably more than their cash income from work and other sources in many cases. And so it really, really can make a difference for a poor family.
Well, here in Massachusetts, where we are, we hear the program is undersubscribed because it's so difficult to get them, and often the benefit isn't high enough to justify all the paperwork to get them.
The benefits are calculated according to a rather complicated formula, but if you have income that's very near the upper limit, the benefits can be very low. And like many senior citizens, for example, who are getting Social Security and have a little bit of other income, may qualify, but the minimum benefit that some get is just $10 a month. And, of course, it's not really worth all the trouble if that's what you're getting.
Mm-hmm. I met a woman like that yesterday who couldn't pay her heating bill and looked into food stamps on disability, and $10 a month was what she was going to get. And she decided it's not worth it.
That's right. Congress in the current Farm Bill is raising that slightly, I think, to $12 or $15 a month, and they're going to index that to inflation. But, you know, it's a program for very poor people, and those who are right on the edge don't get as much.
Are many other states undersubscribed, like Massachusetts? Is the program overall undersubscribed?
Nationally, I think only 55% or so of all those who would be eligible are getting them. That's rising slightly over time. State governments have actually had programs to educate people about the availability of food stamps. I mean, for the states, it's a good deal. They have to pay half the administrative cost, but the federal government pays for the entire benefit. You have rising numbers signing up with these programs to educate people. At the same time, there may be, at least under the current economic conditions, more people that would qualify, too.
Eric, you cover poverty in America for the New York Times and have for many years. What are you seeing right now?
Well, I think there are two big aspects. One, there's the chronic intergenerational poverty, most severe in inner cities, minorities in the inner city, with a lot of associated social problems of unemployment plus violence, drug abuse, and kids growing up without any real chance of getting a decent education. And that's been around, and that's still there, and it's exacerbated by the broader economic issues, because job opportunities aren't there for people that do get an education and want to make it. But then, much more broadly throughout our society, a lot of people who maybe were in the middle class or on the bottom edges of the middle class, the high school graduates with an industrial job, a blue-collar job, who were making 18 bucks an hour and were able to buy a house and a car and thought they were doing pretty well, many of those people are slipping downward. Not necessarily into deep poverty, but into a, you know, they're switching. Their $18 an hour job disappears, and they end up working for $9 an hour at a Walmart or something like that. So it's a rather painful time, especially for some parts of the Midwest.
So you see the middle class slipping further and further behind. Eric, thank you very much for talking with us today about the food stamp program.
Thank you.
Eric Eckholm is a reporter for the New York Times who covers poverty. And this note about the broader economy, specifically new homes. Construction of new homes posted the biggest increase in more than 2 years in April. It's a rare bit of good news for the housing market, which is in a prolonged slump. Most of the new homes are apartments. The number of newly constructed single-family homes declined for the 12th consecutive month. Many economists think housing construction will remain under pressure. You're listening to Here and Now. Tomorrow, horse racing's Triple Crown Watch continues with the 133rd Preakness Stakes in Baltimore. Big Brown, the Kentucky Derby winner, is hugely favored. In fact, the majority of the horses he faced in the Derby won't even be running. Here to talk about the race and the rest of the news from the world of sports is Bill Littlefield, the host of NPR's program Only a Game. Bill, nice to see you.
It's good to be here again.
Well, Bill, at a pre-race event, one of the other trainers said that the Preakness looked like Big Brown's party, and the rest of them were just happy to be there.
Yeah,
that big of a favorite?
He is that big of a favorite. He is what they call a prohibitive favorite in the racing game. He's running against a smaller field than in the Derby. He's running out of a better post position than he had in the Derby when he was way out on the outside in the number 20 position.
Yep.
So, yes, everything seems to be lined up for Big Brown to compete for the Triple Crown 2 weeks hence.
And we've seen a lot of sports headlines such as on-time delivery expected, and they're really making hay of the fact that Big Brown was named after UPS, or
yeah.
United Parcel Service.
Yeah.
And we read that now there's a sponsorship deal. Well, what do you make of this?
Well, the best thing was there was another horse in the Derby called Big Truck. So there really was a possibility that Big Truck didn't come through. But it's America, you know, sponsorship deals, business opportunities. People leap on these sorts of things. Although I also like the fact that there's a horse in this race called Hey Byrn, spelled H-E-Y-B-Y-R-N. I kind of like...
You want to sponsor that one?
Well, you know, I mean, it's like the guy who's a hay burner, but we're going to, you know, dress it up a little bit.
Well, Bill, of course, we can't talk about tomorrow's race without talking about a more serious shadow over it. And that's the death at the Kentucky Derby of Eight Bells, the filly who took second place and then broke her two front lower legs and had to be euthanized. And we also can't forget that the Preakness was also where Derby winner Barbaro broke his leg shortly after he left the starting gate. He also had to eventually be euthanized. Is there any indication that horse racing is taking steps to protect thoroughbreds?
Well, horse racing would like us to believe that they are trying to take steps to protect thoroughbreds. My source for this is William Knack, the guy who wrote the wonderful book Secretariat and another book called My Turf. A very, very knowledgeable fellow as far as horse racing is concerned. And his worry is that the real problem is that breeding practices have simply made the horses more brittle as they've made the horses faster. And short of avoiding certain breeding lines where the brittleness seems to be passed down over and over and over again to horses, it's pretty hard to imagine what people would do. There's certainly a difference of opinion about whether the synthetic tracks are easier on the horse's legs. There's really not enough evidence, according to most people, to decide that. It's hard to say what else you could really do.
Well, moving on down the track, today in South Africa, a runner, Oscar Pistorius, he's a double amputee sprinter who had been banned from competing for a spot on his country's Olympic team, won his appeal, so he can try for a spot or be named as an alternate for the Beijing Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And just to remind people, Pistorius runs with special carbon fiber blades that were said to give him an unfair advantage over other runners. What are your thoughts on today's events?
Well, my thought at this point is that the appropriate governing body has said these carbon blades give him no advantage at all, and he's eligible to try to make an Olympic team or run as an alternate if the South African Olympic Committee decides that that's what they want to do. So good on Oscar. I wish him the best. It is a little bit weird that he plans to run not only in the Olympics, but also in the Paralympics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that's been done before, and there may be some Paralympians who think, hey, wait a minute, if this guy qualifies for the Olympics, what's he doing in our event?
Well, let's go to football for a minute. The scandal over the New England Patriots taping their opponents just doesn't want to go away. Earlier this week, the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, pretty much had declared it was over, and then Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter called for an independent investigation. What's going on here?
I think it just depends on what you want to happen. The commissioner of the National Football League hopes this will go away. That's what he wants to happen, and Arlen Specter wants to be on TV and have lots of people who root for the Steelers and the Eagles remember that he's on their side.
And, Bill, we have to note the retirement of a couple of great competitors this week.
Annika Sorenstam, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, female golfer ever, announced that she was retiring. And Justine Henin, also retired at number one. So often you see that happen.
Well, and at the tender age of 25.
25 years old.
Well, Bill Littlefield, host of the NPR show Only a Game, thanks as always.
Thank you, Monica.
After a break, memories of summer camp. It's Here and Now. School lets out in a few weeks, and it heralds the official start of camp season. Camps are often remembered nostalgically by adults as they label their kids' underwear and pack them up for a few weeks away, sending them sometimes to the hallowed campgrounds that they attended. For some, the memories aren't so great. Author Mindy Schneider captured life at a seemingly less than desirable camp at the age of 13 in her memoir, Not a Happy Camper, which recently came out in paperback. She joins me from Los Angeles to talk about Camp of Yesteryear. Hello, Mindy.
Hi.
Also joining me in the studio in Boston is Betty Bussell, the executive director of the New England chapter of the American Camp Association. Hi, Betty.
How are you?
First, Mindy, take us back to 1974 and the camp you attended, Camp Kinahura in Maine. Read us a passage that gives us a flavor of the camp.
Let me read you the description of how I felt when I first got there. When we finally arrived and pulled into the camp, my heart sank. It looked nothing like the pictures. Saul, the owner, had shown us photographs of an inviting sunny place, all chipper, bright, and freshly painted, the kind of camp Walt Disney or the residents of Oz might have sent their kids to if they'd been Jewish. The shabby little buildings of Camp Kinahura, with their peeling paint and sagging roof lines, made the colonial homes my family toured, the ones held together with sticks and mud and a wing and a prayer, look like palaces. I'd built better-looking structures with my brother's Lincoln logs. We'd been duped. I'd been duped. And I'd convinced my parents to fall for the scam. I wanted to turn around and go home, but I couldn't. My parents had done this nice thing for me. I owed it to them to keep quiet and be miserable.
Well, one of the things that you write about that sold your parents on this camp was a visit from the director who told you the bunks were heated, there was a fresh fruit cart every night before bed, and it was kosher. Was it true?
There were separate sets of dishes for meat and dairy, but I definitely remember the kitchen staff finding it easier to just go with one set. I also know, apparently some of our food was recovered from train wrecks, and I did just recently talk to a friend from camp who told me that in her last year she went into the kitchen and she actually found a can of green beans stamped salvage, and she still has it saved somewhere at her mother's house.
So in a way, you were sold a false paradise. Betty, today, when parents are choosing their camp for kids, could they get away with this?
It would be very difficult to have something like this happen today. You know, now you have websites, DVDs with actual pictures of the camp, and we also suggest that parents do a site visit before they actually sign up.
And there are also private camp referral agents. What do?
They talk with you, and then they try to help match you with the correct camp, because to have the right camp experience, you really need the right match.
And Mindy, in your book, Not a Happy Camper, you and your fellow campers spend a lot of time raiding the boys' side and sometimes spending the night over there. Did anybody seem to care?
It didn't feel like we were supervised, which is really why this camp in its own way turned out to be such a paradise, because it felt like we were doing whatever we wanted, and it felt very safe.
But I remember times in the book where you were, I believe, alone in a canoe in the middle of the night in the middle of the lake, and you heard some rowdy people around you that got you kind of scared, but nothing ever came of it.
It always seemed like everything was going to work out fine. I mean, I witnessed a fire in 74. There were prowlers coming onto the camp property at night. And maybe because I was young, or maybe just because bad things aren't supposed to happen at camp, it always felt like it was more exciting than actually dangerous, and things would just turn out fine. And they did.
My, how things have changed.
Yes, Betty, tell us, because I know the impulse for the girls to raid the boys or vice versa hasn't changed. How is it different now, though, to keep them apart?
Well, safety and supervision at camp is a totally different thing than it was. Now you have adult staff who are up all night. You have counselors in cabins. You may have a little raid here and there, but usually if that happens, it's planned now. So the counselors and the staff know it's happening, but the campers don't, so they still think that they're kind of going on this big raid, but it's part of the program.
And is that just a sign of the times, that staff is much better trained to handle these situations?
Of course it is. So much has happened over the last number of years that there are things now that we do in staff training that we never did years ago. You know, we run criminal background checks now on staff members. We talk about how to touch campers, you know, safety in the cabin, and far more than we ever did before.
Well, Mindy, I found some of the funniest parts of your book were when you leave the camp to go on excursions. You were driving around in cars that were absolutely decrepit. They didn't have seatbelts, sometimes less than competent drivers as well. I'm thinking of one part of the book that I'd like you to read from, where on the return trip, almost everyone is poisoned by carbon monoxide.
Instead of having a school bus, we had this old green cattle truck that looked like it was straight out of The Grapes of Wrath. Let me read you from the book. The truck gave out massive amounts of carbon monoxide, which ordinarily blew out the tailpipe and affected only the unfortunate souls riding behind us. Tonight, however, the wind was blowing in the same direction we were traveling, whipping the noxious fumes back into the truck and into our lungs. It didn't take long for many other campers to grow nauseous. A couple even passed out. Lars, the driver, swung open the back gates. "Everybody out," he screamed into the wind. Those who were able climbed out, while the rest were assisted, and we huddled by the side of the road, too cold to sing, and waited for someone to come up with a plan. No one did, but half an hour later, everyone was able to breathe, and the truck was poison-free. This became the way to get home. Lars drove the truck as fast and as far as he could, 15 minutes at a stretch, and then he'd pull over again. Binging and purging on carbon monoxide, the half-hour trip back to camp took 4 hours and 20 minutes. It was the second worst road trip I've been on so far this year.
Well, at least he got you out of the van.
but Betty, I wonder, do camps still take off-site trips, or are there so many safety concerns that they just rather stay put?
No, many camps do off-site trips. What's changed again is the supervision. You wouldn't be able to drive a vehicle like Mindy's talking about now, because before anybody goes in the van, you have to do a safety check, you have to check the tires, the driver has to have a certain license. So that absolutely would not happen now.
Well, Mindy, even though this camp sounded from your book like it wasn't very great, didn't have much programming, the food was salvaged, as you say, from train wrecks, but many, many kids came back year after year. You don't say in your memoir, but I'm curious, did you go back?
I went back for 6 summers, and I still considered myself a newcomer. I'm still in touch with people who went there for 18 years and more. Some people started at age 4, and they only stopped because they graduated from college, got real jobs, and couldn't keep coming back. It was absolutely a wonderful place, and I'm very lucky that I fell into it.
Well, that's what camp is all about. If you have a camp experience, it can change your life. There are marriages that happen because people went to camp. You've got grandparents, their children, their grandchildren, all who've gone to the same camp because of the wonderful traditions that are there.
It sounds great, even though it doesn't always read like it's a paradise. Mindy, just one more question. In the book, you're an awkward 13-year-old, and really all you want out of camp is your first kiss. And you also yearn for a nose job. So I'm just wondering, did you get either of them?
Let me start with the less embarrassing question in there. Yes, I did get the nose job, and yes, I did eventually get the first kiss as described in the book, and I really hope I masked the character enough that should that guy ever read it, he won't recognize himself, because it really was just the way I described it, unfortunately.
Well, you'd have to read the book to hear it, because it didn't sound pleasant. Mindy Schneider, author of Not a Happy Camper, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Betty Bussell, executive director of the New England chapter of the American Camp Association. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlott, Karen Miller-Medson, Jill Ryan, and Hitesh Hattie. Doug Shugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our intern, Rachel Conowitz. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman, and the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. Robin Young returns on Monday. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.